my understanding that an amendment is being copied and will be down here shortly. So if you want to begin discussing the bill, that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I do have before you the A2 amendment, which I will offer, and perhaps rather than voting on it, we can hold off. We'll discuss it and not vote on it until the other amendment, which is more technical in nature, is here, and we can incorporate them together, if that would be okay.
Yes.
Okay. Would you like me to just then address the A2 amendment,
yes,
which is a delete all? So, members, the bill that you have before you today, Senate File 260.
We do need to move it, so I would move adoption of the A2 amendment, and then you bring the other stuff before us, right?
She wanted to amend the A2 and then adopt it all at once.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Okay, very good. Thank you. So this Senate file makes two major changes to Minnesota election law. It moves the date of the state primary from the first Tuesday after the second Monday in September to the second Tuesday in June in each even number year, and then it changes the beginning of the time period for voting by absentee ballot from 30 days before the date of the election to 45 days before the election. For many, many years, we have debated in the state legislature whether or not we ought to move the primary from September to June. And so I bring this bill forward because I do think that it is very important that we make this change. I think that we have a unique system in Minnesota. We use a caucus system, and in fact, we're one of only seven states that does use a caucus system to endorse their candidates, and that has some real advantages. One of the advantages is that it offers great participation. You know, we can look at what happened this last election cycle. We had record turnout at our caucuses, and so people are very engaged. They feel a part of the process, and that's a good thing. But if you follow that out, the number of people engaged in the process gets smaller and smaller. And so while we had tremendous turnout in February, at the end of the day, the amount of people that endorse their candidate is approximately 120 people at a congressional convention or CD convention, and then those people go on and do statewide endorsing as well. This is the system that the parties have chosen, and we are not here today to debate that system. However, if in fact a challenger wants to be on the primary, the way that it is right now makes it very difficult. There's only, as I stated, 120 or so people making this decision, and so the public has not really had an opportunity to weigh in any significant way. By having a primary in September, we make that very difficult for really a few reasons. Number one, it is very expensive to wage a primary fight. If it is in September and then finish your primary fight, you've only got the time between September and November to be prepared for a general election. And so the types of challengers that allows for is really those challengers who are self-funded. I think that is a system that we as Minnesotans don't endorse. It's very important that our elected officials, you know, are open to everybody, that every citizen has the opportunity to run for office, and that our system should not favor those who are able to self-fund. Another problem with a September primary is that you end up during the time between the endorsing convention and the primary waging, you know, all sorts of negative battles against each other, and then at the end of the day, one person emerges the winner, and that person has very little time in which to let the general public know, diminish the weaknesses that have been pointed out, and present their strengths. And so what that does is it really is a disincentive for people to make that challenge. And so I think, in essence, the September primary limits the public's ability to have the very best and broadest selection of candidates put before them. It is for those major reasons that I am advocating for moving the primary from September to June. That would give the challenger, you know, plenty of ample time to raise the money for the general election, and it would allow for more balanced view of the candidates to be presented during the interim. So that is essentially the philosophy with which why I am bringing forward this bill. I do have testifiers to talk about why they support the bill, and I am honored to have them with me today, and I will call on them. But before I do that, I would like to just go through a brief section-by-section summary, which you have before you.
And Senator Bonoff, we do have the A4 amendment here now, so at this time we will
move it.
Senator Rest moves to incorporate the A4 amendment into the A2 amendment.
Madam Chair, I don't yet have it before me, so I'm sorry. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I would move the A2 amendment incorporating into it the A4 amendment.
All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the section-by-section summary, sections 1 through 4 is the public subsidy conforming amendments. It makes conforming changes to the timing for payment of public election subsidies to conform with the new date provided in this bill for the state primary. Section 5 is the locations for absentee voting in person. It changes the beginning of the time period allowed for voting by absentee ballot in person from 30 days to 45 days. And frankly, it was this change that brings forward many of the other technical changes to conform with making that change. I believe that one of our testifiers, Secretary of State Ritchie, will speak to why that's important in terms of making sure no voter is disenfranchised. Sections 6 through 12 and 14 to 23 are also conforming changes, making changes to the time period allowed for election activities. Many of these changes are intended to allow sufficient time for the preparation of absentee ballot materials so that they are ready for use no later than the 45 days. Section 6 is the cutoff date for the county, state, and federal affidavits of candidacy. Section 7 is the combined polling place cutoff date. Section 8, deadlines for boundary changes. Section 9, cutoff date for appointment of election judges. Section 10, deadline for notification of filings with Secretary of State. Section 11, deadline for preparation of absentee ballots. Section 12, cutoff date for the preparation of the form for summary statements of election returns. Section 14, date for municipal primary. Section 15, cutoff date for filing affidavit of candidacy for city or town office. Section 16, cutoff date for municipal clerk to notify county auditor. Section 17, date for school district primaries. And I would say a comment about that. Most school districts opt to have their school district elections in odd-numbered years so that they do not correspond with the general elections. However, if a school district does not, for one reason or another, do this, this does change when they have their school board election. So I presume that the Education Committee would want to see this after we are done with it. Section 18, cutoff date for filing affidavits of candidacy for school board primary elections. Section 19, the notice of the election requirements for the school district elections cutoff date. Section 20, cutoff date for notification of changes to the electronic voting system. Section 21, cutoff date for the notification of major party presidential electors. Section 22, expansion for time allowed for posting of non-commercial signs. And then Section 23, the cutoff date for affidavit of candidacy for hospital board elections. It seems that whenever you change one thing, there are many repercussions. And actually, we learned that there were some housekeeping changes that had been missing from the last version of the primary bill, and so we're using this occasion to do housekeeping cleanup changes as well. Section 13 changes the date of the state primary in each even-numbered year from the first Tuesday after the second Monday in September to the second Tuesday in June. Section 24 makes the bill effective beginning with the state primary in 2010.
Senator Bonoff, I'm sorry. You just referenced that this has some technical or housekeeping items in it. Could you explain more what those are, what doesn't relate specifically to changing the primary date?
Madam Chair, there were some changes that were requested by the Campaign Finance Board, and actually Gary Goldsmith is here to review those changes.
Mr. Goldsmith, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'm Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. If the Chair would repeat what the question was, please.
My question was, I believe that Senator Bonhoff referenced that there were sections of the language that were technical changes and not related, that were not related to the actual moving the primary date. I think it's sections 1 to 4. So if you could please explain that.
Sure, correct, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Essentially, these were submitted to the Campaign Finance Board for review, and I did review them. Some changes were made which are incorporated into the A2 amendment. So this is the amendment version that the board has reviewed and believes is doesn't present any problems for the board or make any substantial changes in the public subsidy program. Essentially, these are conforming changes based on dates, and they substitute provisions of the statute where a date certain was listed, for example, September 1st, to a date based on the date of the primary, which would give the approximate same time period between the date certain and the current primary as would be given under the new statute and the primary that's an earlier primary. I can go through these specifically if you want to, but essentially they are just,
they're just
moving
conforming
the dates to conform to an earlier primary, yes.
Great, thank you.
Senator Ress.
Madam Chair, I have the A3 amendment that I'd like to offer that I've discussed with the author, and it's bringing another group into the primary to be affected by this date of the primary, and it is the Soil and Water Conservation Officers. to make sure that, or right now, they don't have a primary, and they end up with 10, sometimes 10 people running for a single position on the general ballot, and this would allow them to also have a primary so that for each office, the on the general election ballot, there would only be two candidates. So, Madam Chair, I move the
Senator
A3
Ress
amendment.
Moves the A3 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Bonhoff, I'm also told that there is a technical amendment that Mr. Bodern would like to make or tell us about.
Madam Chair and members, on page 6 of the A2 amendment, I think there are a couple of numbers that have, in the course of preparing the amendment, were inverted. And what I would like to do is first read to you, if you look at section 11 on page 6, it has to do with the deadlines for delivery of absentee ballots. I think the way that sentence should read would be, at least to conform with the author's intent, would be at least 45 days before a state primary or state general election and at least 30 days before other elections. And that would provide the 45-day time period for absentee ballots in election years, in general election years, excuse me. Those numbers were, if you look at the original language, transposed. I can read it to you again if you would like. What you can do on page 6, lines 19, 20, and 21, delete the new language and insert at least 45 days before a state primary or state general election and at least 30 days before other elections, comma.
Madam Chair, I would make that motion to amend.
Senator Ress moves that language. Is there any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Bonhoff, would you like to call some of your testifiers?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, could I ask a couple of questions first? Senator Bonoff, are we a state with the latest primary? Is anybody that has a primary after ours?
Madam Chair, surprisingly, there are a few states that are also in September. So I think our date floats, and so it's hard to tell. But there were some other states that did have there's a September 14th, for example. Right now I have only the dates before me that also had caucuses, but I did go through the whole list, and there were a couple that were farther. I would say two-thirds were before us. Of the other third, maybe half of those were about, you know, most of them were about ours, and then one was after.
And, Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, what were most that were earlier than ours in June, or were they in August?
There were, I would say, a split between June and August. And more in June, some in August.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, were there any that were earlier than June for a November general election?
There is. Indiana is on May 6th.
And they are a primary state?
I mean, they do
a primary.
They do a caucus and a primary.
They do a caucus. Okay, thank you.
Senator Bonoff, your testimony.
Madam Chair, I'll ask Secretary of State Ritchie to testify.
Mr. Secretary, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mark Ritchie, Secretary of State, and I've testified before many times in favor of moving the primary early, and our top priority in the past has always been the problem that we create for our military and overseas voters. This year, it looks like we will have somewhere between 500 and 600 of our overseas, mostly military voters, whose ballots have come in one or more days late, and therefore, under current law, they're not their votes cannot be counted. And, of course, this is a problem that we face all the time. But that serious problem, it's been pointed out to us many times by the Pentagon, Department of Defense. 45 days is their minimum recommendation. They may even be moving towards federal legislation requiring 45 days minimum on absentee voting for our military and overseas voters. So that's been our concern in the past. But last year was a special year, and we learned a couple other things that have made me even more urgent about this question, and I'll cover them very quickly. The first was, you may remember that we had a recount in the primary in a statewide race, which was a Supreme Court race, and it went very quickly. There were no contest that resulted. There were no challenges. It was very non-controversial and, of course, a very small number of ballots, relatively speaking. But what it pointed out to us was that even with a simple recount, there were some counties who were simply unable to meet the timeline that we currently have established in statute for getting our absentee ballots out. And if there had been any form of a challenge or a contest that had resulted in any kind of a legal proceeding, one day, 1 week, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, whatever it might have gone to, it would have created a train wreck in the general election, the November 4th. It is not clear how we would have proceeded. We would have to gone to court and have some judge someplace tell us how to handle that problem. And I don't believe we ever considered that problem prior to last year. And now we know we have primary elections too close to our general elections to be able to handle a recount that goes to contest. And then the final part is what we've seen by putting an electron microscope on our whole system through the recount is that the primary at such a late date puts a tremendous pressure on our local election officials and on our whole process, especially the absentee ballot process and others. And by compressing this timeline, we have seen that it does create problems for local election officials. Mistakes get made. Things get done in a way without the proper amount of time to be able to test and recheck and test and make sure everything was done right. So in addition to our prior concern, which was that this timeline was too short to make sure our soldiers and others could vote properly and get their ballots in on time, we've also learned that we cannot have a primary this close to our general without a potential disaster, and that the compressed time frame has created problems for our local election officials that we need to address so that we can really learn from what we've seen in the contest, in the recount, and make our system more secure but also more efficient and have less errors going forward. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
Thank you. Secretary Ritchie, how many other states have 45 days that have absentee ballot provision?
Mr. Secretary.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, I do not know for sure. Department of Defense has made this their recommendation for about 10 years, and I think they've claimed a pretty high success rate in getting 45 days. Almost anyone with a slightly earlier primary could easily make that date. It's for those of us with September primary. So, for example, the August primary states, I'm sure, would all make that 45, the 45-day thing. But I can
they
also
make 45 days for the general election, but do they also have 45 days prior to the
primary,
which this bill would call for?
Madam Chair, Senator Ress, I don't know for sure, but we could find out quickly. I have a good chart of this in my office.
I would appreciate knowing that.
Great.
Thank you.
Mr. Secretary, your office is also advocating for early voting legislation, and so how do you anticipate that is moving in concurrence with this proposal, which would change it to 45 days from 30 days?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in my meetings with the local election officials in the counties, which I've been doing over the past few weeks, we've been discussing the procedures by which they would incorporate the early voting option, where you could walk in, there would be a machine, you would have your ballot, do it. Most of them have expressed the desire to have this as conforming as possible, meaning as similar, but all of them said, you know, whatever the legislature would like to do, it's fine by them. The process now is one where the absentee voting process is the early voting procedure, and so people are choosing that option. So however many days are assigned to the absentee ballot procedure, there will be some people who choose that as their early voting option if there isn't a normal early voting option. If the early voting option is adopted by the legislature, and if it's for a shorter period of time, people will choose the absentee ballot process in the days that the early voting option is not available. I think most of the election officials that I've spoken with would like these to be the same because it's easier to explain and to understand and to staff. But everyone is in favor of finding a true early voting option to reduce the number of absentee ballots that are being handled.
Mr. Secretary, I'd just be surprised if it was the general consensus that election officials thought that we should move to 45-day period of early voting, though, or 45 days of voting in person.
Madam Chair, the issue that people have is having too many different rules. And the rule on absentee voting is a very specific rule that affects especially overseas voters. For a local election official, having to explain to someone who comes in that if they were overseas or if they were an absentee voter, they can take an absentee ballot. But if they want to come in and vote early, they need to come back in 15 days. That just seemed like, you know, kind of a complicated thing to say, but nobody seemed to think it was a very big deal one way or the other. What I've heard from many people is that they would like as many of the rules and timelines to be relatively the same, you know, so that there wasn't, you know, different kinds of things. But the testimony that's being prepared for federal legislation on the 45 days does not contemplate how states might do their early voting. It only contemplates the question of absentee voting at all. So if the
including absentee in person?
Yeah. If the federal government moves on the 45-day, it would be, you know, from their initiative, and it would not necessarily affect how Minnesota might choose to do early voting.
So explain to me again why we need to move from 45 days or from 30 days to 45 days for this, specifically in this legislation, Mr. Secretary?
Well, Madam Chair, the 45 days has been the longstanding recommendation from the Department of Defense division that handles our overseas voters. Mm-hmm. And we know that right now, with the 30 days, we have hundreds, in this case this year, between 500 and 600, which come in 1 day late, 2 days late, 3 days late. 45 days would add 15 days or merely 50%.
Right, but and I understand that, but I'm trying to get at why we are including this policy change in the early primary bill explicitly, why your office is advocating for that instead of moving it in a separate bill or saving it for a different bill.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, if that would be the better path for having that discussion, that would be fine. But I would defer to the author on this particular question.
Senator Bonoff. Madam Chair, it's fine with me to leave it as part of this bill. The office has talked to me about the importance of having it there, and so I would keep it in this bill and have it go forward together.
Senator Bonoff, I understand why you may think that this is a good idea to keep it in this bill, but since I'm going to have an early voting bill come before the committee on Friday, and as the Secretary said, it would be perhaps easier for local election officials to have some continuity in terms of early voting and absentee voting, I would be inclined to take this provision out of your bill with the understanding that we keep it, then it would just remain the way it is. Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, that it only, I understand it only makes sense if it's dealing with the trying to stretch the time between the primary and the, I mean, it makes more sense, trying to stretch the time between the primary and the general election, because right now, between, and that's why it's here, because the time between the primary and the general election is not 45 days in Minnesota. So it would be appropriate to say, if you, in a bill that moves the primary date way back or up or whichever is the right word to use there, to put the 45 days in this bill or whatever number is going to be there, but certainly longer. I mean, if the Pentagon is requesting as a standard 45 days, then right now Minnesota couldn't even get there because of when our primary date is. And so since she's bringing a bill for the primary, changing the primary, I think it's appropriate to put the 45 days in there, since this is the first time that you'd even have the opportunity to do it 45 days before the general election.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, you're absolutely right. You couldn't do the 45 days unless you did move the
law.
Primary. So right. they're somewhat codependent in that way.
What you could do under current law would be to say that absentee ballots for our September primary could go out 45 days before. And that might be...
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, absolutely.
We could make that change in another bill. I mean,
Madam
make
Chair.
It both places, but you could make it in another bill, even if this bill didn't pass, at least for voting in the primary, you could have a longer period that would meet the Pentagon's requirement, even if we're not able to change the primary date to allow 45 days between the primary and the general election. That'd be the only thing.
I think that makes sense.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Okay. Is there any other? Would you like to call your next testifier?
Madam Chair, so are you comfortable for now leaving it in the bill?
I'm comfortable for now.
Okay.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you. Okay. Next testifier would be Brian Melendez.
Mr. Melendez, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brian Melendez, and I'm here in my role as chair of the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I had the privilege of testifying in the previous legislature about a similar bill. The DFL party has been on record and continues to be on record in favor of moving the primary from September to June. I had the honor last time to appear with my Republican counterpart, Ron Kerry, who was also testifying in support of the bill in the previous legislature. There were a couple of points that I made last time around that I would like to make again and a couple of new points, and then I'll conclude and answer any questions that the committee has. Last time, the statement that I made to the committee and which continues to be relevant is this. An earlier primary date will give the voters more time to get to know the candidates that they will be voting on in November. An earlier primary date will reduce the time spent on inside baseball within the political parties and will refocus the political debate on the truly significant public issues that our elected officials must address. Moving the primary earlier will result in a more transparent, more publicly focused election process, and I'm pleased that both Democrats and Republicans agree on this important reform. Those statements remain relevant. In fact, the State DFL Central Committee voted on this as recently as February 2007. The Executive Committee reaffirmed it in December of 2008, so just a couple of months ago. The two additional considerations that I hope the committee will now take into account are, first of all, the issues that Secretary of State Ritchie has addressed much more effectively than I can about getting a recount or an election challenge processed between the primary election and the general election. But the other is the fact that both major political parties have moved their precinct caucuses from March to February. I believe I made the point last time that it doesn't make a lot of sense to spend 7 months letting the parties pick their candidates internally and then just give 7 weeks to the voters to figure out who is actually going to run the state of Minnesota. Now that we have added an extra month on the front end of the process, there's even more of an imbalance between the time that we spend inside the parties picking candidates and the time that the voters get to spend on the general election. The parties can much more easily accommodate a June primary with a February caucus, which we now have, as opposed to a March caucus, which we had before the last election cycle. And so for these reasons, Madam Chair and members of the committee, the DFL party supports Senator Bonhoeff's bill, and we hope that you will too.
Mr. Chair, are there any questions for the witness? Thank you, Mr. Melendez.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Chuck Slocum to come to the table.
Mr. Slocum, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chuck Slocum. I'm a citizen who's been engaged in this game for a long time. I've been to 19 straight precinct caucuses. How many people in the room can beat me on that? I need my head examined. We vetted this issue for a long time. Political reform and party reform is really hard to achieve when you must come to the people who are the most successful in the system and ask them to change the rules. Now, we've wisely allowed parties to have a lot of freedom and a lot of movement to pick candidates and to do their work. And there are only a few things that we ask the state to do. One is to set a precinct caucus date, and the other is to set the election calendar consistent with the laws. I think it's in the groups that I've been involved with, including a lot of time with the Grow Commission over a decade ago, almost everybody agrees we need an earlier primary for the reasons previously stated. We spend too much time on the inside ball and not enough time crafting and gaining public engagement with campaigns on the outside. And when you have a mid-September primary and then the rush to the election, we don't have time for the thoughtful and wise way for people to get engaged. There are only four things that parties do, essentially, and I'm sure Chair Melendez would agree. The first is they recruit candidates and they support campaigns. Very important job. The second is they develop issues. And the third is they identify voters and get them out. And the fourth is they raise money to pay for as much of this as they can. In order to do our jobs better as political parties and as citizens, as an outside individual, as well as a party, as a Republican activist, I would urge, and my party has previously supported widely, the notion of an earlier primary, and we support Senator Bonhoeff's Senate file to do so.
Thank you very much, Mr. Slocum. Senator Rest.
I've been to, Madam Chair, I've been to 19, I just did it.
Okay.
I've been to 19 precinct caucuses, too, in a row. We're both kind of old.
Yeah.
Madam Chair.
But you're smart.
Senator Bono.
Madam Chair, I should also say that Mr. Slocum was a former GOP party chair as well, so he speaks with that hat on as well.
Senator Gerlach.
Madam Chair, I have a question for the author of the bill. Well, actually, two things. I didn't have anything for Mr. Slocum.
Thank you.
Two things. One is, some of the bills we're doing, they have an impact on other bills we've heard previously. And I know that Senator Rest had the bill about allowing 17-year-olds to vote in a primary if they're going to be 18 in the general. And I had mixed feelings on that, but I just wanted to point out that where there was a two-month gap there, September to November, now we're expanding that to 5 months, which means that nearly half of 17-year-olds would then fall under your bill. So it just might be something to consider. If that's the intent, we're starting to get pretty low on, the age. But we're not getting in. I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if this bill passed, I as I indicated before, there are other problems with that 17-year-old one, and I would be very, very cautious about moving that bill if we went to a June primary.
And then, Madam Chair, then also a couple questions for Senator Bonoff. I'm supportive of this bill, and I co-authored it with Senator Dan Larson last year, and we agreed early on that this was a significant enough of an elections bill that it's not like a lot of the other smaller, minor stuff that we're dealing with, that this is one of those that has the interest of a lot of members of the legislature and the parties and activists and such. And so what we did to promote that is we knew that we had to have both parties' support. And so Senator Larson at that time, he pursued the route through Chairman Melendez there, and my job was to do what I could do to get Chairman Kerry on board and such. My question is, because I don't see him here, but have you had contact with the Republican Party leadership, with Chairman Ron Kerry, and have you talked with him about this go-round this year? Did you invite him to testify? And also the other parties as well. We can't also forget the Independence Party, the Green Party, which I understand is now the number two party in Minneapolis. I learned a few weeks ago. So anyway, but there's other parties involved as well. Why aren't they here today testifying?
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, I did call Mr. Kerry right away and asked him to testify, and he didn't say he was opposed to the bill. There was another provision in the bill that he was opposed to that actually Brian Melendez was also opposed to that I took out in the delete all, which had to do with a threshold for endorsement, which I won't go into since it's not in the bill.
Okay.
But he said that he didn't choose to testify at this time, and I don't know what was behind that. I didn't ask him, but that's what, I have reached out to other Republicans as well, but that was my first call. I called Brian Melendez and Ron Kerry on the same day. It didn't occur to me. I should have reached out to the other parties, and I think they ought to be talked to, and before I make the next stop, I will do that. And Senator Day is a co-author on the bill, and so he and I have talked, and he's been offered to take a leadership role within his party as well. But I'd love to have your help in that.
Okay. So I'm not sure, Senator. You said Senator Day as well. Okay, because that was my next question. Is on the copy I have, I just have Bonoff, Rest, and Sieben. I didn't have. It doesn't show.
Madam Chair, Senator Day and I think he wasn't there, and we
spoke.
Yeah, exactly. So perhaps it's not on there, but he is definitely my partner in this, and was aware we were doing it today. And so I'll make sure to get him at it. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, then, Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, then I'm pleased to hear the answers on both of those. There was some involvement with you reached out to Ron Kerry, and then also that you do have some Republican authorship on this, because it, again, on major bills, author added, good, that a major bill like this, and I think you'll agree on anything, if it's one-sided or even perceived to be one-sided, then the whole thing collapses because it's one group pushing it onto another one. And so I'm pleased to hear those things, because I'm for the bill, and I think it should go forward. And so if you can maintain that balance, maybe get some letters from some of the other folks if they're not testifying, at least to show the rest of the members that there is a broad base of support for it. But I'm glad to hear your answers. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Senator Gerlach, I would love to work with you more on this. I've reached out to Annette Meeks, who would also like to help, and she has been active in the past and in the Republican Party. So I'll work with you.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I understand both parties and a lot of activists and a lot of legislators like this, but I think the one thing I heard the least often after the campaign last year is that voters really want a longer campaign. I don't think I heard a single person out there in the public say they thought we needed longer campaigns. And if this is the second Tuesday in June, I'm thinking I've checked some years that's exactly three times as long of a general election campaign. Most years it's 2.5 times as long, 20 weeks instead of 8 weeks. And I don't disagree that the primary phase, the candidate selection phase, is too long proportional to the other way, but I would much prefer we try and move it the other way. I'm very sympathetic to some of the local election officials and people trying to have to deal with very difficult timing issues with absentee ballots, and I'm very sensitive to that and think we have to keep working at that, and I'm supporting a number of other bills that I think will take care of that. But I think when you look at how people learn about political issues, look at other countries and so on, it's not the length of a campaign that makes it effective. It's not the length of a time, how many months we can beat people's heads with these 30-second idiotic commercials. And that's basically the political consultants, the media folks, they love it the longer the campaign. They love that. And but people don't, the more time we spend in a campaign, the faster people get burned out by it. And by the time they decide they don't want to pay attention to the beginning because they're not ready to make up their minds yet. And when they're ready to make up their minds, they're sick of it. And I think what I was hearing last October is I wish this campaign would come to an end. And here, if we do, what will happen is if we move the primary 2.5 times as far away from the general, is we'll simply start seeing the ads we generally see more in the summer now. It's already beginning to hit the springtime. We're going to start seeing them in the winter and early spring. I think all you're doing is lengthening the campaign season, and the whole argument that that we need parties spend all their time fighting with each other and then the voters don't know who to pick. I think the one of the last times that our party has had a highly contested race in the primary, I think it was 1998 when Skip Humphrey was our party's primary winner, and he came out of a very intense 4 or 5-way primary. I don't remember how many people, but there were a lot of them in it. And he came out of it, and people said, oh, now he's trashed. He can't possibly win the election. He came out of it 10 points ahead in the polls. In 8 weeks, he lost that lead, but the point was he wasn't because he had a tough primary he got beat. I think the issues have 8 weeks is plenty of time to get the issues out to people. And I guess I agree with you that there's a problem we spend too much of the time on the inter-party stuff, but the solution isn't to lengthen the other one because there is plenty of time in a general election. And I still have not heard anybody say what issues people don't have time to get out in 8 weeks.
Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, the campaign season isn't going to change whether or not we change this primary or we don't change the primary, because the campaign season begins in February when we have our caucuses. So I like, you know, what happens in England, the way they do their campaigns, the public financing, the short campaign season. That would be my first choice, Senator Marty. I don't see us going in that direction. But given the system that we have, this bill is not about me, you know, in any way, shape, or form, but I happen to bring personal experience to the process because I went through it. And so I can tell you that having that you are campaigning no matter what, that entire time, in fact, well before it, because you're gearing up for February. So it is a very long cycle, and that is a completely different issue. But going back to where the primary should be, we owe the public a chance to have the greatest amount of input over who is on the ballot. And that's a check and balance. We let the parties do their endorsement, but our check and balance to that process is a primary. And right now, the way it's structured, that check and balance is flawed because it is the rare candidate who is able to even be a challenger because of, number one, loyalty to party, number two, finances, number three, the nature of the risk because of the shortened cycle. So what this does is it says this can allow for the public to have the greatest ability to bring forward a candidate they want to vote for.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I seem to have heard much the opposite argument most of the time. Back when the Grow Commission adopted this recommendation 15 years ago or whenever they did, and that was that this would strengthen the party endorsement processes because you wouldn't have so long for the challengers to go in the campaign against the endorsed candidate in the primary. You compress the date, you have the convention, you have the primary right after, you don't have as much chance. The other thing is you put the primary in the summer, you're going to have a lower turnout, and the party endorsement process will have more clout, which is an okay thing to have. I'm not arguing for or against here. I'm just trying to say that I've heard the people who initially pushed this were saying that the party endorsement process is too much clout and we should move the primary up so they'll have less clout, and I hear you saying the opposite.
Senator Bonoff.
I mean,
Madam Chair.
The Grow Commission, excuse me, I restated that thing at the end wrong. They were arguing, I'm sorry, I've stated it wrong. The Grow Commission was arguing that the party endorsement process, I think they had a number of recommendations that the parties make multiple endorsements and that you had to get certain percentage of vote at a convention in order to get on the ballot. And then that the convention had to be very, very close to the primary because that way it was going to be much more determined by the caucus convention system. And I hear you saying that we want to have a better check and balance in the primary.
Madam Chair, the Grow Commission said that if you had 30% of the delegates supported you, that you could be an endorsed candidate on the primary. And so it was a very close link. And that was the idea, was that you wouldn't want to put all the power in that, you know, who that small group picked. And so that was one way they dealt with that. So I actually don't think we're coming from a different place. I didn't choose to put that in this primary because I was advised against it. I don't think the bill would go very far if I had put that in this bill, but I know that that is what the Grow Commission came up with. And Senator Marty, you know, I doubt that you're going to support this bill. And there isn't probably anything I could say that would have you support this bill. And I appreciate, you know, you've been around this for a long time. You've put yourself forward, you know, several times, and I respect that. And so I know that you bring your experiences to it. And so, you know, we may not agree on this. But there was one thing. There was something I actually thought that the facts
full committee,
were wrong.
You can remind me. Okay.
I'll remind you.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on the bill? Okay. Senator Rest, would you like to move the bill?
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate file.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Rest, I forgot. There is one more technical change.
Amendment.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, there's one additional change that would be necessary to preserve existing filing deadlines for municipal elections held in March. And you'd need to look to the A4 amendment to incorporate these changes, which I think can be done orally. On page 1, line 6, before in, insert held in March in any year or in November. And then in page 1, line 7, after election, insert held in November. And then on page 1, line 9, before in, insert held held in March in any year or in November. And finally, on page 1, line 12, after election, insert, held in November.
Madam Chair, I would move that.
Senator Rest moves the oral amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Rest, would you like to make
Madam Chair, I move that Senate file 260, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the full committee.
All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Bonhoeff. And
thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Senator Lori has been waiting. Senator Lori, Senate file 848 is before us. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. She said we have Senate file 848 before us, and that was actually that last technical amendment was a nice transition to this because that did have to do with township elections. And I noticed that there's no folks on your subcommittee from township, so maybe I'll start by, this is a township elections bill, and I'll start with just a little bit of how we do things in the township for our...
Lori, just to clarify, though, some of us do represent townships.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I know that. Okay. But we have an annual meeting and combined with an annual election in March every year, and that's the historic and still the typical way that we elect our town boards. There's three supervisors, each with a three-year staggered term, one up every year. And we have a couple of provisions to work on this. The first is really a cross-reference. A while ago, we allowed for the annual meetings to be moved in the case of bad weather, and we neglected to put that same option in to move the elections. And so we're really adding a cross-reference to make sure that the combined annual meeting and elections can be moved. So that's all Section 1 does. And there's also been a provision for a while for townships, if they choose, to hold their elections in November along with the general election on a two-year cycle, and the rest of the sections of this bill have to do with that. The first of them would allow a township to, after some experience, to return to elections of their supervisors in March rather than in November. They would have to do a couple of things. They would have to run the November elections for two cycles, 4 years, to make sure that they had experience with it and were thoughtful about whether they wanted to move back. The process to get them to be able to move back to March would have to be passed unanimously by the board and then voted on by the electors ultimately. So I think there's a good set of checks and balances there to make sure that they really would like to do so. And then also, after some experience with running the November elections, we're proposing that we add an option for a township to go to six-year terms for their members. Right now, when they move to a November election, it's a four-year term. And with three board members and a four-year term, no matter how you structure it, there are years where a super majority is up in one election, and bad things can happen when you put a super majority up at one time. So a township that is running their elections in November would have the option to go to a six-year term for their officers. Again, this would have to be ultimately passed by the electors at the during the election. So that's really all the bill does. And I've got Kent Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships with me. Happy to entertain any questions.
Did you want to add anything, Mr. Sulem?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kent Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. I believe Senator Lori did a great job of summarizing the intent of the bill. I'll just add that the procedures that we have set forth are all modeled under other existing procedures already used by townships for optional forms of government or the procedure for changing elections. So the process is what's used for other areas. It's just applying it now to these sections where we were quite surprised to realize that going back to March elections, we don't think we're going to see a groundswell of it. That moved in November, it's working quite well. But it's the only area of law where you can do something and not have the authority to undo it if there's problems. So.
So it just creates the clear process using existing procedures.
Yep. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Mr. Sulem, how many townships now use November?
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, the last update I saw in ballpark numbers was a little right around 500 of the nearly 1,800, most of which did it many years ago were the larger urban towns in the metro area, and they're quite happy. A handful have added it in recent years with some of the changes to election laws and other issues and working with their county auditor. But a handful have discovered that their issues are getting lost when buried under a state election ballot and that type of thing. So they've just asked for the flexibility, but as Senator Lurie pointed out, we make them live with it for a while so they know that they've worked it out well and not just knee-jerk reaction.
Madam Chair, Mr. Sulem, what year did we change it so we allowed the townships to choose? Because I remember the townships were opposed to having the choice a number of years ago. They wanted us to limit it so only the metro townships were able to choose November. When did we change that? Was that 5, 6, 8 years ago?
Senator Marty, Madam Chair, Senator Marty, it predates my time with the townships, which is 9 years now, so it's prior to 2000.
Okay.
Senator Lurie asked me that question, and I'm sorry, that's one that I didn't research. I'm guessing it was sometime in the late 90s.
Yes, Madam Chair, it was kind of interesting to have the townships arguing against giving them the choice. But they insisted only the metro townships should have the choice. Don't give it to us in rural Minnesota. But if 500 out of them, roughly speaking, of November.
Approximately.
Senator Lurie, I'd just like to make two small grammatical corrections on line 1.15 and on 1.17. Capitalize the M in both cases for March. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
This motion is adopted. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, yeah. Senator Lurie or Mr. Sulem, would there be times when they would have both a March election and a November election for the general election for everybody else? I mean,
that is the standard. I mean, we have the November elections, you know, in conformity with law, but we also have March annual meetings and elections for our township officers is the standard procedure.
And so that's not that is, Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, does that get to be an additional expense for people who chose that, or I just not understand how that system works?
The townships that the townships that have switched still have their annual meeting in March. And running an election is not an undue burden. I mean, the way we typically do it is we just we have the elections running for a period, and we actually shut down the elections for an hour and just change our hats and have the meetings. And people come either a few minutes before the meeting and vote or stick around after the meeting and vote. And it works pretty well. So, I mean, moving the elections back would be, you know, I don't think it would be any additional expense. And it would be, again, to move it back would take a unanimous vote of the board and have to be passed at the by the electorate. Only after running it in the November cycle for two cycles, so at least 4 years of experience.
Any other discussion? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on Senate File 848? Senator Rest moves that Senate File 848, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the full committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Lurie. Senator Rest, Senate File 157.
Madam Chair, I'm bringing you the subcommittee Senate File 157, which deals with establishing a presidential, reestablishing a presidential primary in Minnesota, and I have the A3 amendment, and I would like to incorporate one change to it, and that is on page 3, and I'm going to ask, it's an oral amendment to it, I'm going to ask Mr. Bodern to tell us the language that needs to be deleted.
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, on page 3, line 8, delete appropriate. And on page 3, line 9, delete major political party, and after presidential, insert primary, and delete everything after ballot before the colon.
Senator Rest incorporates that amendment. Incorporates that language and
so that sentence would read, after filing the affidavit of candidacy prescribed by subdivision 2, the following individuals must be listed as candidates on the presidential primary ballot, colon.
All right. Senator Rest moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The last year, following the precinct caucuses, we had a hearing and a lot of testimony about the overwhelming number of people that turned out for the precinct caucuses, and following that, people recommending and some editorials. I think you have one in your packets from the Star Tribune about the bill as proposed by the delete all amendment before you to rethink that again. And I would claim that we actually did have a presidential primary, but it was done in a very chaotic manner, and that what we need to do is to bring some order and structure to that. And although we may say, well, it's only very, very unusual that to have such a highly competitive primary that our highly competitive race for the nomination of our presidential candidates, it seems to me that we would do well to be prepared for that by having a presidential primary that is separate from our caucuses. So the bill makes changes from the delete all makes changes from the changes from the bill as introduced by taking out the primary for the candidates for the Soil and Water Conservation District supervisor seat. We put that primary language into Senator Bonhoff's bill. It had also had a provision to bring judges and county commissioners within the definition and requirements for public official. And what that would have done would have been to bring them into the reporting requirements for the campaign finance board. And I got a very lengthy memo from Mr. Goldsmith indicating just how much of an additional burden that would be for the campaign finance board to have hundreds of new people having to file with them. So while that might be a good idea, we're not going to take it up at this time, and it really wasn't appropriate for this bill. The bill as introduced also did have the 70-year-old voting in the primaries issue in it, and we put that in a separate bill. So what's left is indeed in the delete all amendment just the requirements for a presidential primary. And I'll just go through it briefly, section by section. In section 1, we indicate that the presidential primary would be held on the first Tuesday in February of every year that there is a presidential election, and that it applies and then at the end of that, that the precinct caucus, the party caucuses, will be held on the date of the presidential primary, when we do have a presidential, when we would have a year of a presidential election, so that the parties would be able to hold their caucuses on other dates, or in the date that's already specified in law in a non-presidential year. In section two, right now we have presidential preference ballots in the caucuses, and they would be eliminated, and the only preference ballot that would be done in the caucus would be in the year in which a governor is running. So it eliminates the preference ballot for everyone except governor. Section 3 and 4 have to do with allowing public meetings either to be held or not to be held based on whether the presidential primary and the precinct caucus is going on at the same night. But when we do not have, if the party chooses to have something different than what is in the statute for their precinct caucus, the same rule about public facilities, public meetings being canceled does not hold. And as you may recall, we had an issue with that because one of the parties this past year chose not to hold their caucuses on the day, the major parties chose to hold their caucuses on a day other than the one specified in law. And since a school board that met on a Tuesday night had canceled their meeting one time, then they were going to be, if they had to also go by what the statute said, they'd have to cancel their meetings again. So we changed that law so that that would not happen. And the same thing is in here. And Section 4 talks about the use of public facilities being made available to the caucuses for the purposes of the caucuses that would be held on the presidential primary day. Section 5 requires that a presidential primary be held in a year in which the president and vice president are nominated and elected. And the voters can either choose between a candidate who is filed by two means, an affidavit of candidacy, to vote for that person, or can instruct their party to, by voting for, or instructing their party to not have any committed delegates, and in matter of fact, having them indicating a preference for uncommitted delegates to their national party convention. The date would be set by the Secretary of State consulting with the major political parties, and the goal would be, we have talked about before, of creating a Midwest regional primary, setting the date so that we don't interfere with what is going on in other regions, or trying to one-up Iowa or New Hampshire, but trying to arrange to have them have that regional primary with other states that we define as the Midwest, meaning any state that is entirely west of Pennsylvania, north of Arkansas, east of Wyoming, and no later than 5 weeks after the first presidential primary. And the idea is to be relevant in the selection of delegates to the national convention. In the contests, I believe that we've had before, the presidential primary was so late that it didn't, and that happens in some states too already now, happens that they that presidential primary becomes irrelevant. But we're trying not to make it a race to be first, because we saw, I think it was Michigan and Florida, that got into trouble with choosing their delegates before New Hampshire and Iowa, and had some trouble getting seated at their national conventions. In Section 6, we provide for who is going to be on the ballot, and you can get on the ballot one of two ways. A person who submits a filing fee of $5,000, and anybody who is nominated by petition. In 1992 presidential primary, we had the provision for getting on the ballot by petition as well, 1,000 votes from each of the congressional districts, but the filing fee was only $500. It seemed to me, to because we do need to be concerned about costs and things like that, that raising that filing fee, but still allowing as an alternative the ability to petition to be on the ballot, was a reasonable balance. The bill that we saw before us last year that Senator Larson had authored did not have the opportunity for a candidate to file by petition. In sub 2 of that, it does apply only to those candidates running for president. So there's we don't have people running in primaries or caucuses to be vice president, so it's only president. The time for filing and these timing things are set so that they dovetail into one another, allowing enough time for people to get the candidacy declared after the Secretary of State announces when the date of it is. And I won't go through what the sequence is, but it is one that works. The presidential primary is in Section 7. It's conducted, would be conducted in the same way as any other election that would be under the laws of the state primary. However, that's run, so it's just a conforming reference. The Section 8 deals with how the county auditors would be noticed and prepared for the by the Secretary of State, the ballot preparation. Section 9 explains that the presidential primary would have an impact on the selection of delegates, and if the party chose not to use the presidential primary as the means of selecting their delegates to the national convention, keeping in mind that people could also vote for uncommitted delegates, and that there is an escape clause for candidates between the primary and the convention for candidates who drop out, for their delegates to be redistributed among the delegates. But if that process is not followed, then the political parties cease to be eligible for 10% of the general party checkoff dollars, and they cease to be eligible to issue a political contribution refund for the remainder of that year. If there is not a sanction, then it becomes it really just becomes a preference rather than an actual election, if we expect the parties to abide by that. The The next sections deal with the costs and the way in which the local election officials or local election local jurisdictions may be reimbursed for their costs up to a cost of $480,000 by the Secretary of State, and how that the reimbursements to local governments, county auditors, whatever, is to be apportioned based on the number of people registered in that jurisdiction on the day of the election. Section 11, for a presidential primary, there is still an affirmation to be made that you would be in agreement with the principles of the party, the same kind of affirmation that you would make if you went to a precinct caucus. However, no one would know which party it is you're making that affirmation about. In 1992, people spoke, you know, when they went to the polls, they asked for a particular party's ballot, and that became a matter of public record. We're not requiring that here. Each portion of the of a single ballot would have a given party's candidates on there, and what the voter would have to be careful in doing is only voting in one section. So
that would be clearly explained.
And that would be the Secretary of State in term is instructed at the end to make sure that sample ballots and example ballots would be clear to the county auditors. So you would make that affirmation, same as you do in most party caucuses, but you would only be seeing a sample ballot. And I guess it's mostly just, and that part is just a matter of trust. Same thing if people show up at a party caucus that end up not voting for members of that party. And again, the section 12 is deals with the way in which the ballot would be set up. In section 13, example ballots and sample ballots that would be prepared by the Secretary of State. Madam Chair, we had a lot of testimony last year. And following the caucuses, and I don't have any additional testimony to offer. The bill that you have before you in the Delete All Amendment, again, is the same bill that made it to the floor of the Senate last year, with that one exception of allowing a candidate to get on the ballot by petition and raising the filing fee from $500 to $5,000. And that, of course, that particular move is to make sure, on the one hand, that the people who are on the ballot are serious presidential candidates, and on the other hand, there is still the opportunity for grassroots candidates that may only be in this state by petition, by getting signatures, to also appear on the ballot.
Senator Rest, in the section 13, when it references the sample ballot, have you thought about having the county auditor post the sample ballots in the actual precincts or in the polling locations instead of just in the auditor's office? With the idea being that if this is if people aren't used to voting this way, it might mm-hmm. be helpful to have an actual sample ballot posted in each polling location.
I think that would be a good idea. I don't have any language to accomplish that.
I think it could.
They do have. It does require them to either put it up in their office or on their website.
Right. I wonder, Mr. Bonner, if we could just add after auditor's office, comma. And in each polling location?
On election day?
On election day? comma, strike or, and add and.
Madam Chair, perhaps we can do that for the time being and polish it up a bit later if it needs a little work.
Okay, I will say that again. So on line 7.14, after the word office, insert a comma, and the words and in each polling location on election day, strike the word or, and then the rest of the language would stay the same. All those in favor of that, please say aye.
Aye.
Madam Chair, how about if I offer that amendment, because usually it's appropriate if the chair wants to offer an amendment that she turn the gavel over to someone else.
Okay.
I would
be able
to do that.
Senator Rest.
So I would make that motion.
Makes that motion. All in favor, please
Madam
say
Chair.
Aye.
Madam Chair, if we do that, would we, and remove the word or, would we want to put and in there?
Yeah, you
oh, I'm
and.
Sorry, I didn't say that. Thank you, Senator Gimsey.
And
I was just kidding.
So it would, just to clarify, it would read, the county auditor shall post the sample ballot in a conspicuous place in the auditor's office in each polling location on election day and on the county's website. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Motion is adopted. Is there Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, several questions and one. Maybe they're all questions, but on page 2, line 3, last year at the caucuses, I remember a lot of people who were voting in the straw poll at the caucuses who were, what do you mean, I don't get a vote in the Senate race, too? And I'm wondering, I assume there was no reason that it's been excluded, but the U.S. Senate races, which are 2 out of 3 elections, I think there is as much interest in them often as in the almost as much as in the presidential race and the governor's race. I wonder if you have any feelings about adding that, because people thought those were the two races they were aware of.
Well,
Senator Rest,
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, with the U.S. Senate race, we have, I mean, that is, we have a primary already, a state primary in which they're chosen, and we have. The caucus system in both parties that leads to a convention, which leads to an endorsement. So I don't know who you'd be electing delegates for, and it's not supposed to be a. It's not the actual state primary, and that's why it has a separate election.
Madam Chair.
Marty.
Madam Chair, this is the U.S. Senate. It's the same as the gubernatorial one, though, and that's just a straw poll, and people
oh, you mean,
who came
I'm sorry.
There, people who came there were very interested in being able to put their name in it.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I thought you meant them being
no.
part of the presidential
no, no,
primary.
No.
You're talking about
the preference ballot.
Page 2, line 3.
Sorry. To indicate their preference for the office of governor and
U.S.
Senator.
And Madam Chair, I just remember after caucus night last year, which was an amazing event as we mm-hmm. for all of us, there were a lot of people who, well, we didn't have room in the classroom, so I just went and voted and left. But I wanted to say where I was going to be in the U.S. Senate race, too, because those were the two visible ones. And I would.
Okay with that.
You okay with that?
Mm-hmm.
If so, Madam Chair, I'd move that we add after office of governor before the period and U.S. Senator.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Bodern.
One small suggestion on that might be for the odd 1 out of every 3 election years where you won't have a U.S. Senator available, just to add the words if applicable, so it would read and if applicable for the office of the United States Senator.
Madam Chair, the same thing would be for governor, so you might want to put if applicable because the governor is only up every other. So the if applicable
could be at the end.
The office of governor and U.S. Senator. Or when applicable.
Senator Marty moves that amendment. So it will read for the office of governor and U.S. Senator if applicable.
When applicable.
Applicable.
I'm fine with that.
All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion is adopted. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, question on page 2, line 32, roughly. How many states is it that lie entirely west of Pennsylvania, north of Arkansas, east of Wyoming? Is that like 15, 20? I'm just curious roughly how many. I can't picture in a map how many that would include.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I did not look at the map. I took that language from Senator Larson, so I don't know. But it would definitely be Illinois, Indiana,
Ohio,
Iowa, North Dakota, South Dakota,
Missouri,
Wisconsin,
Kansas, Nebraska.
Madam Chair,
Senator Pat,
we're in a compact called the Midwest Higher Education Compact. I believe there are 13 states in the compact.
So that'd be roughly
that same area.
And
Senator Marty.
And Madam Chair, the Secretary of State, are this goal of the Midwest Regional Primary, I know it's been talked about for many years, is Secretary of State's office involved? Or is there somebody discussing that as we speak, I mean, this year?
Not that I know of exactly, but they would be, the Secretary of State would be encouraged to consult with
Ms. Fraser's right back
but
there.
But with the parties to arrive at a date. But she can speak to it.
Ms. Fraser, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. The regional rotating primary is a proposal that is supported by the National Association of Secretaries of State, who represent all of the secretaries. So from both political parties, and Senator Klobuchar is actually carrying a bill related to a regional rotating primary, and we are supportive of that concept.
Senator Marty?
And Madam Chair, Senator Ress, this is, when we talked earlier, you talked about possibly doing it on the same day as the caucuses, but for confusion reason, the assumption is it would be a different date now?
No, Madam Chair, the precinct caucus in the presidential primary year would be the same day as the presidential primary. That's the bill also that we had last year, so that the polls would close and then the precinct caucuses would take place after that. There was an issue brought up about making sure that you have adequate separation between the voting and the caucuses, but I think that in most places that could be accomplished without interfering with the voting, having that end and having the caucuses start later.
Madam Chair, the one concern, and I think it's a good idea to have it the same day, but I keep thinking all the people who are involved in the electoral process, election judges, election officials, many of whom, while they're nonpartisan in that role, are fairly active in one party or the other, and the assumption is they'd just be very late to the caucus if they made it, or?
Madam Chair, that issue was also brought up to me about people that are right now, the way in which you, as I understand it, the way in which you participate as an election judge is to sign up at your precinct caucus, and that's how the party gets a list. But the party could have other ways of getting getting election judges that would still allow those election judges to participate as an election judge in the presidential primary times, and as you just mentioned, perhaps just go late to the precinct caucuses themselves.
And Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, one final, I guess it's more.
And these are not complicated ballots either.
Right,
so
right. It's
the
one.
Counting of them, it should be fairly straightforward.
And Madam Chair, Senator S., just one, this is more a comment, and that is in Section 9, the selection of national convention delegates. The way it's worded, the parties don't have, it's a pretty low threshold for what they need to do, because just thinking of the past year, assuming there were three candidates in our party's one that I can remember who were alive at caucus date, Edwards, Clinton, Obama, and assuming they all had 33% of the vote, or, well, Mm-hmm. One of them had 20 and the other two had 40, let's say. Then, in effect, if the one candidate drops out, and more likely it's going to be more candidates at the beginning and a lot of them drop out, when it could still be a very hot race between two people, even if they were tied at 40% each, the party would have pretty great flexibility, so one could get 50% more votes than the other one just because that would happen through the process. If you wanted to tie it down more firmly, you could. I'm not arguing that you should, but you could tie it down that the proportion between the remaining candidates had to be roughly reflected in the polling, but I'm not sure that makes sense either, because 3 months later, whenever it's 6 months later, it's a lot different story. But it's not, the delegates are not bound as much as this makes it sound, I think.
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, that's correct. I mean, it does allow for the flexibility, particularly if candidates have pulled out, but the candidates themselves have some influence over they get to say who those delegates would support that supported them, and or, you know, the rest would be uncommitted, which means they could support anybody, right, as you just pointed out.
Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, I think I was wrong earlier. I think there's only 11 states.
Okay.
Because I couldn't think of any others. North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Kansas, Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, Nebraska, Missouri.
Okay.
So if anyone in the audience can think of any other states. Though I was north of Arkansas through me.
Is there a map? Senator Rest, do you have anything to add?
Nope.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak on this bill? Senator Rest then moves that Senate File 157 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the full committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Aye. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Gerlach? Senate File 804?
Be clear.
And I should also mention for anyone in the audience, Senator Pappas indicated that she would like to lay over Senate File 834. I should have announced this earlier. I hope no one was waiting for that bill. But
I was hanging around just for
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. This is a bill that will go, I think, pretty quickly. It is a Secretary of State housekeeping bill. And, of course, by housekeeping, we mean technical changes, removal of obsolete language and statute. We mean taking out statute that's been ruled unconstitutional and cleaning up statute books. And I have, for what it's worth, I've gone over this here with Ms. Fraser from the Secretary of State's office. And and I agree that I think that everything in here is really non-controversial. We are going to have a little amendment here to take something out, but it is technical things, and we can go through it rather quickly, I think, answer questions, and move it along.
Senator Gerlach, would you like to move the A3 amendment to
get
the bill
initiated? Yes, Madam Chair. I don't have it in front of me, sure. But if that's the correct number, it is the A3. Oh, because we had the A2, so it would be the A3. Yes, Madam Chair, I would move the A3 amendment.
Senator Gerlach moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Ms. Frazier?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So to walk through the bill, as Senator Gerlach said, these are conforming, non-controversial changes. So Section 1 of the bill changes the word permanently to indefinitely in relation to overseas voters to conform with federal law in describing expatriates, basically. On the author's amendment, we just made an identical change in another section of statute in 203B16 subdivision 2. Section 2 deletes obsolete language that says notwithstanding rules on absentee ballot forms, because we've changed the rules, so there's no longer rules to notwithstand. Section 3 removes the requirement, overly prescriptive requirement, that absentee ballot applications be arranged by precinct and then in alphabetical order. So it's allowing counties to arrange them in whatever method they think works for them. Instead, inserting language that already applies to them, which says that they need to be maintained like all other election materials for 22 months. Section 4 makes the statute more concise without changing its meaning. Section 5 removes a cross-reference to a section of statute that was ruled unconstitutional. Section 6 repeals the exception for holding a special election during the 19 weeks before the state primary election, because this school district general election is now always held in November of either the even or odd year and is no longer held in May, so that exception no longer makes sense. Section 7 and 8 clarify that 4 election judges are now needed in all elections, which is already required by statute that requires 4 judges if you use electronic voting equipment. So this clarifies that 4 judges are the norm unless you are a township or a standalone hospital district election with very few voters, in which case you only need 3. Section 9 requires the Secretary of State. We're already required to provide instruction posters. Currently, the statute says we only have to provide them for precincts using paper ballots, but again, since almost all precincts now use optical scanners, this just changes the requirement to conform with what we actually do, which is provide them to all precincts. Section 10 is similar to a bill that Senator Scheid had in that it adds the word or affirm to an oath. This is an oath that polling place challengers take. Her bill was related to election judges. Sections 11 and 13 delete language related to programming costs and recounts, which is no longer needed because last year you all changed the law so that recounts have to be done by hand, so there's no programming of equipment. Section 12 specifically states which jurisdictions have responsibility for recounts on question. So if you want a recount on a school district question, you file your request with the school district. This is the current interpretation of the law. It's just spelling it out so it's crystal clear to everyone where requests need to be made. Sections 14 and 15, again, remove a cross-reference to a section of statute that was ruled unconstitutional. Section 16 codifies 1994 session law, stating when the terms of city council members of charter cities end, that they end on the first Monday in January. Section 17 provides a cross-reference to another section of statute that allows for the cancellation of town elections. Section 18 was deleted in the author's amendment because the school board association had concerns about it. Section 19 again codifies a section of 1994 session law related to when the terms of school board members end, and they end on the first Monday in January. Section 20 specifies that a petition to call a special election for questions for a school district is filed with the school board. Again, this is the current interpretation of statute, just spelling it out so it's clear to everyone. Section 21 clarifies that the usual timing for designating polling places applies to school district elections. It's assumed at this point, but again, we're making it very clear. Section 22 adds language to ensure that presidential and vice presidential candidates cannot file for another office in Minnesota. Right now, the statute prohibits any candidate from having more than one affidavit of candidacy on file, with very limited exceptions for like township offices or soil and water offices. However, in Minnesota, presidential and vice presidential candidates don't file an affidavit of candidacy, so there's kind of a loophole here which we are closing. Other states have different rules. In Connecticut, for example, Senator Lieberman was allowed to run both for re-election as a U.S. senator and for vice president on the same ballot. This would prohibit that and close what we believe is a loophole and could be an unintended consequence right now. Section 23 is the repealer. We're repealing 3.22, which has language related to expenses paying for the publication that used to be required by 3.21. The Secretary of State's office used to be required to publish information about constitutional amendments. That language was taken out in 1992, but this language in 3.22 remains about how we're supposed to pay for a publication that we're no longer required to publish. 204B.22 subdivision 3 is obsolete language related to the number of election judges required in the polling place. 204D10 subdivision 2 is the unconstitutional language that for which the cross references we were removing. It was found unconstitutional in a case called In Re Candidacy of Independence Party Candidates Moore v. Kiffmeyer. That was in 2004. We're deleting 206.57, which is absolute language related to the establishment of the Election Assistance Commission in 2006, and section 206.91, which is obsolete language forming the Voting Machines Working Group, which completed its task in 2007. The one other thing that was done by the author's amendment is on the section related to swearing or affirming, it was putting the words "or affirm" in parentheses. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Frazier. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on Senate File 804? Senator Gerlach moves that Senate File 804, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the full committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Gerlach. Ms. Frazier. Senator Pappas. Again, Senator Pappas chose to lay over Senate File 834.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to mention, though, if you wouldn't mind, just explain it to the committee and talk about the committee's time. Hopefully we can still have it heard in subcommittee. The St. Paul City Council hasn't had a chance to review the bill. It relates to them, and they're too busy with budget stuff. But if I could just explain the problem before we lay it over. Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, this is an issue that affected the city of Minneapolis a couple of years ago, and it really would be very nice to have the endorsement of the cities of the first class in it. And if we don't do it if we run out of time to do it in the subcommittee, mm-hmm. I will just hear it in the full committee.
Okay. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Then do you want me to not say anything about it?
Well, maybe you can explain the problem.
I can explain it quickly. I know we're running out of time. Okay, so the situation is with Senate File 834, what we're trying to correct is in 2007, the St. Paul City Council ran for election. Then in 2010 will be the census. So the challenge is, can we get the new districts in place where there's been more than 5% or more population change in place in time by 2011 so that we have new districts? Because the way it's been, we would have old districts because of the time to do that. For us, we run in 2012 and in 2010. So in 2013, there's no election scheduled for the city council, so they wouldn't run until 2015, which is a full 5 years after the census. So I was just talking to Mr. Mansky, and he had mentioned that his goal would be, because the city council doesn't run the same year the mayor does, they're running at opposite times, so they can all run for mayor. His goal would be to try to get the districts ready by 2011. So we just need a little time to figure out and see if that's possible. Okay? We will lay
Thank
that
you.
Aside. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So next, Senate File
837. Madam Chair and members, what this would do is change the current structure for receiving funds for candidates to receive funds from the state general account. It doesn't really affect the primary account. Currently, candidates of major parties receive these funds in September after the state primary election is certified. And that was the change. We used to receive them after the general election. So this will revert back to the original design and also require candidates to receive a certain percentage of vote in the general election in order to receive these funds. So they prove viability. And that percentage is 15%. Now, you know, that's kind of an arbitrary number. If members were comfortable with a different number, I'd be open to that change. But I really feel that in order to receive the taxpayers' money for in an election, that you need to show that you have a viable campaign, you are a viable candidate. And so I just set that threshold at 15%.
Is there discussion on the bill?
Just a few more comments, Madam Chair. So right now there are three ways in which you can show that you're a major political party, and you only have to do one of the three. You don't have to have a voting threshold. That can be one way. You can have a voting threshold of only 5%, or you can have a large number of candidates that are running, 45 candidates for state house, 23 candidates for the state senator, four candidates for congressional races, and one candidate for each of the major statewide offices. So that would be another way you would prove that you're a major party. And the third way would be to do a ballot petition containing the signatures of at least 5% of the total number of individuals who voted in the previous state general election. This law says that even if you've accomplished one of those things, you still have to receive at least 15% in the general election for a statewide office.
Or a legislative seat.
Or a legislative seat.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
Even the underlying, what you're striking to from primary to general, how can they certify that before the election?
Senator Pappas.
Or am I not reading that right?
No, it's after the election.
Well, it says the board must distribute the available money in the general in the general account as certified by the commissioner on that date, not that's distributed on that date. I see. I'm sorry. I was confused.
It's confusing. I think that election law is confusing. So, I mean, I think our really policy decision here is how we want to define a major party candidate. And I think that we used to have a higher threshold, and that got lowered. There was a provision changed in 2001 in the conference committee to lower the threshold. If you remember who was governor and who was chief of staff then, that happened. And I just think it's, you know, that 5% doesn't sound major to me. 15% is a better number, that threshold.
Mm-hmm. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pappas, I wasn't even paying much attention because I was thinking that this was just about the disbursements here, and I wasn't paying attention. But I have a question for you on this. So your bill, then, by increasing the threshold, your intent then is to make it more difficult for parties to qualify as a major party. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. Honestly, it is, because I think for a major party, to qualify as a major party and receive taxpayer money, I think you should have to demonstrate that you're a major party. And 15%, you know, I think that's even borderline about major.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, then, and if you don't make it, then you get cut off from the public finance.
Right.
Right.
Right. You have to reach that 15% threshold in the general election.
Okay. Well, Senator Pappas, have you... have you run this past the Independence Party and the Green Party and the Libertarian Party and everybody else? How do they feel about us doing something like this? I would imagine, well, maybe I'll ask first, have you had any discussions with any of the minor parties or the people who are currently major parties that are between 5 and 15%?
Senator Pappas.
Like the Independence
Madam
Party.
Chair and Senator Gerlach, I confess I have not. It's kind of my idea, and I haven't, you know, none of the parties came to me with this proposal, and I just haven't had a chance to consult with them.
Okay. Well, Madam
Chair. Probably they won't like it.
Let's get a floor vote on this, then.
That's what?
I said let's get a floor vote on it, then, Madam Chair. go. Yeah. No, I think it's a bad idea. I think that we want. I thought we were trying to open some stuff up, and I don't know. It kind of feels like we're pulling the ladder up from some of these parties that have been working hard to add some pluralism in our system. And I don't know. I don't think they would, you know, take on this. But that's
Madam
my opinion.
Chair and Senator Gerlach, so for the last 8 years, we've had this more generous provision where you only needed 5%. And I have not seen a lot of growth in these parties. I've not seen them become active in legislative districts across the state. You know, you mentioned the Green Party in Minneapolis. That's it. I have not seen them, their candidates receiving significant amount of support from the public. And they've had plenty of time to prove themselves. They've had the last 8 years. And, you know, I have not seen that growth. And so my concern is that they get a lot of money to run campaigns, and I don't see them making an effort to prove they're really viable.
Senator Gimsey.
Can you tell us how much is currently being distributed out of the general account to these parties that are at 5% or less?
I apologize, Madam Chair. I can't. I mean, I certainly can. If you ask me these questions, I can certainly look up the answers before full committee, but I don't know.
Madam Chair, maybe Mr. Goldsmith knows.
I was going to say, Mr. Goldsmith looked like he wanted to testify on
that. Oh, yeah,
Madam,
you're a good person.
You noticed that. Thank you, Madam
Sure.
Chair.
Mr.
Members,
Goldsmith, excuse me, just 1 minute. Senator Gimsey had a follow-up.
And just in case Mr. Goldsmith might be able to answer both of my questions, my other question would be, if these minor parties no longer are receiving funds from the general account, do those dollars go back in there and then they're distributed amongst the rest of the major political parties? Is that going to give more money to, say, the Republicans and the Democrats? That would be my other question.
Yes. Senator Gimsey, Madam Chair, members, I want to clarify a couple of things. First of all, whether a party is a major party or a minor party is not governed by Chapter 10A, and this bill would not affect the categorization of a party as a major or minor party. That categorization is covered by either the Secretary of State or the Revenue Department, and I believe there's some of the statute in both. The summary of the bill is correct in explaining how you become a major party, but that's not part of Chapter 10A. As I understand it, what this bill would do is say that if you are a candidate of a major party, nevertheless, you have to get 15% in your individual election before you're going to get this general account public subsidy payment. And so that would apply to Republicans, Democrats, and the Independence Party. We have three major parties right now. The Green Party is not a major party. They're a minor party. Secondly, I want to make the distinction between the general account, which this bill talks about, and the checkoff money that's to the parties. Checkoff money is available to candidates of both major and minor parties, and that would still be available. The general account comes from an appropriation from the legislature that's a standing appropriation, and also a percentage, also checkoff money that is delegated to the so-called general account. By a statutory formula, a certain percentage of that goes to governor candidates, a certain percentage goes to other constitutional officers, a percentage to Senate, and a percentage to legislative candidates. And by statute, the board determines, with the Secretary of State's certification, the number of candidates who are qualified to receive a portion of that and the percent that's allocated, for example, to the Senate, whatever that dollar pool is then divided equally among the qualified candidates. So this bill would probably have the effect of making that pool of qualified candidates somewhat smaller, thus the amount of money going to the ones that actually can prove viability by getting 15% somewhat larger. It would not affect the amount overall that's paid out or the burden on the general fund of the state. As far as how much is actually paid out from the general account, first of all, the Green Party, being a minor party, doesn't qualify, so they get zero. And to be honest, I would have to go back and check those figures. It is significant. It was, I'm sorry, Senator, I will have to provide those figures to you, and I can do that by email, and I'll be at the whole committee hearing on this bill, and I'll have those figures for you.
You have them at that time. That's fine. Yes. Thank you.
Okay, sure.
Senator Pappas, it seems like there are some issues with your bill. do you have any comments on what Mr. Goldsmith said or any thoughts about what you want to do?
No. I don't think that – I think he explained how it works. But I think the basic premise of the bill is the same, is that in order to really prove that you deserve the legislative appropriation and the checkoff and the general fund, you should prove that you're a viable candidate. And I think that is 15%. The committee could disagree with me on that and think it's a different number.
No, I'm sorry. I misunderstood and thought that the bill was drafted wrong to the wrong section of statute. But I guess now I see what the clarification is.
The clarification was that I might have misspoke when I talked about what it means to be a major political party. But even if you're a major political party, by other definitions, I think you should still have a 15% viability rate in order to receive money from the general election fund.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on this Senate file, 837? Senator Pappas moves that Senate file 837 be recommended to pass and referred to the full committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Pappas.
And we're done.
And seeing no more business before the committee is adjourned.
Okay.